engineers and genius staff who had been serving the U.S. after the Second World War formed ARPA's corpus, but not all of them were American. For example, in Alabama's Huntsville missile site, German engineer Wernher von Braun was making weapons that were badly needed by the Army. By the help of such people, ARPA led major projects to success, including Defender, Vela, and Agile. U.S. Army personnel who had secretly tested the hydrogen bomb were caught by surprise once again. The evidence of an atomic blast was found in Alaska. In response to the U.S., the Soviets tested their first bomb. The investigation revealed that they had made at least three atomic bombs. The radar systems in the U.S. were not connected, and they could have stopped working in an aerial attack. The airplanes that flew in a low altitude could easily enter the U.S. and do the job, a counterattack, or maybe a coup de grace. The solution was to connect radar systems and use the most advanced computer back then, the Whirlwind. So the Lincoln Lab was established. MIT assessed the Air Force's old plan, the Charles Project, an advanced warning network for defense in the face of a large-scale attack named SAGE. SAGE was a continental system based on 23 centers that could simultaneously trace 400 planes by using a more advanced computer named the FSQ. In 1962, Licklider, an MIT professor and author of Human-Computer Coexistence, who was looking for a really smart system, was hired by ARPA and was put in charge of the Information Processing Techniques Office, the IPTO.
The computer technology has been moving in a way that nothing else people have ever known.
According to an instruction by the Department of Defense, ARPA was assigned with linking the main computers in Mount Shin, the Pentagon, and the Air Force headquarters. It was a fledgling agency which was run at a lower cost. The goal was the conceptual aspects of command and control programs for strategic aerial command. The agency was the main arm in airstrikes and was an important factor in missile attacks. The project funding was not a small amount, $5.8 million. In 1965, ARPA launched a project to create a real network. The technology was based on a theory by Paul Baron, breaking messages to smaller packages. After an extensive endeavor, finally, on October 29, 1969, efforts were made to link up the first two nodes and establish what was later named ARPANET. We typed the letter L and we asked, "Do you see the L?" They said yes. We typed O and asked, "Do you see the O?" And they said yes. Then we typed G and the system crashed. The first link between the California and Stanford universities was set up. It was a success. The network was invented. ARPANET expanded and the users could share information, but the management of the network wasn't handed over to the private sector because it was an achievement by ARPA, which was working under the Department of Defense, which had completely military priorities. In 1972, ARPA expanded its military activities and was renamed DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. In 1973, the first satellite network communication between California and Hawaii was set up, and it eventually reached London and Norway. The more ARPANET expanded, the harder it was to find out who was using it. They couldn't figure out who was linked to the network. There was no supervision. On the other hand, The political situation was chaotic due to the Vietnam War, and it had affected the U.S. The opponents of the Vietnam War, like Muhammad Ali and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., were under watch.
I have a dream.
The combination of the fast expansion of the network and lack of control over the dissidents could turn into a serious national security threat. Militarism brought the expanding ARPANET under the control of the Department of Defense. The access was more limited than before. And after a while, MILNET, namely the Department of Defense's military network, was completed and was preferred over ARPANET. Telecommunications protocols were an important issue. ARPA's preferred model was definitely TCP/IP. The Europeans suggested the OSI model. ARPA was the winner. The Foundation of Science said using ARPA's model was obligatory. Granting the finance to establish university networks was conditional on using the TCP/IP model. The pretext was ARPA's model could recognize the saboteurs of networks more quickly. The network served as a new source of revenue for the U.S., and as the Department of Defense demanded, TCP/IP was established. At the same time, hidden layers emerged, so it was easier to recognize people who logged on to the network. In 1983, establishing a network by using smaller networks based on the telecommunications protocols of DARPA was defined. After the networks linked up, the internet came to existence. Identifying the computers in the network was an important issue, which was resolved with IP. Every system had a specific number. ICANN was created to protect the technical aspects and the DoD policies. ICANN, based in California, determined the name and number of computers on the internet. The identifiers included the names of domains, IP addresses, and many other parameters. The interesting point is the U.S. government is still the determiner of the names of domains on the internet and controls purchase of domains.
As most know, the internet grew out of U.S. government research, and ICANN grew out of a 1998 commitment by the U.S. government that would allow the private sector a leadership role in the management of the domain name system.
ARPA's progress in information technology would guarantee U.S. dominance. But the Department of Defense dreamed of more advanced products. Therefore, they decided to make a huge change in the telecommunication and computing industries by investing on the very large-scale integration, VLSI. By executing the program, stunning technologies came into being. The outcome was 24 different products that had a huge impact in DARPA's continued progress and Silicon Valley companies like Cisco, Adobe, and Sun. The synergy between DARPA, universities, and the market was a good business model. Everyone was at the service of DARPA, and DARPA was at the service of the U.S. Defense Department. The CIA's intelligence activities were forbidden on U.S. soil, but sometimes some terrifying news was spread about the activities of a secret agency that was spying on people. Efforts were made to reveal the secret. After a year of hard work, Perry Fehlwalk, in an interview with Ramparts magazine in 1972 under the pseudonym Winslow Peck, revealed that there's a large espionage agency whose funding was bigger than the CIA. The hiding giant was emerging, but such news stories weren't noticed. The Australian Prime Minister was not aware of his country's agreement with the U.S. for a long time. After Morphy laid into the Australian Security Intelligence Organization in 1973, the clandestine deal came to light. People didn't know that the Pine Gap space station in Alice Springs, which was supposed to be involved in space missions, had turned into a monitoring station based on a secret deal and was run by the CIA. There was a plot. It took James Bamford 10 years to blow the cover from a spying system in 1982. The most important revelations were made from within the spy station. Margaret Newsham, director of computer systems, who had been working for Lockheed Martin in California for 10 years since 1974, was a coordinator of the NSA's classified software in Menwith Hill Station. Her task was to install and run some software named Echelon on Lockheed Martin computers. It was clear what the agency was doing, monitoring and spying. She blew the whistle because of corruption, defrauding, and personal abuses at the agency. According to Newsham, phone calls by Senator Strom Thurmond were consistently eavesdropped on by the NSA. The NSA, the so-called no such agency, was spying, and it has penetrated people's lives to such an extent it was aware of what they were doing. After a while, in 1996, Nikki Hagar, a journalist, in his book named The Secret Power, revealed New Zealand's role in the espionage network. Based on documents, the Australian and New Zealand governments had been involved in espionage for a while and were completely aware of the developments in East Asia. A year after the book was published, Hagar and John Campbell, in a courageous move, entered the YOP station while they were filming the incidents in the operations center.
And actually, there's no people there. The whole system can run itself.
In 1988, in an article titled Somebody's Listening, authored by Duncan Campbell, the nature of the spying activities came to light. He had been under watch by the British spy agency from 1976 for the revelations he made about the GCHQ. He had achieved more details. He revealed the roles played by the US, Britain, Australia, Germany, Japan, and their program within Project 415. The satellites were not launched into space to track missiles or for telecommunication purposes. They were used solely for spying. Echelon was done. Echelon had its roots in the Second World War to track Soviet waves based on an agreement named UK-USA. The two major projects back then were Transit to track Soviet satellite communication and Echelon to track global satellite telecommunications. From 1962, there was an expanded supervision, and Echelon was used against ordinary civilians as well. It was dangerous. The technical know-how to track communications was achieved by DARPA and the NSA. Ordinary emails, faxes, telexes, and telephone calls all over the world were being tracked, listened in, and logged. The important point was Echelon had targeted all governments, organizations, and even ordinary people. To bypass the law that prohibits surveillance on citizens, the US and Britain used a simple trick to spy on their own people. They were spying on each other's sins and shared the results in the same computer. Echelon would single out the important keywords from among a large number of contacts and conversations. The keywords would include names, neighborhoods, subjects, and stuff like that that were significant for spy agencies. The important point was each country had its own list. For example, New Zealand didn't know which list the US would use to assess information that it received or who the subject of the surveillance would be. After Echelon, privacy was gone forever. After more revelations, more names surfaced. Shamrock, Project Minaret, counterintelligence operations, and Operation Chaos. The last one was the CIA and FBI special smear campaign against dissidents. It was different from the program that was launched against students. Echelon was picky. It used a specific program to spy on different groups in Washington, D.C. The revelations reached the embassies. Mike Frost was in charge of installing surveillance tools inside the embassies. He made some revelations.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
U.S. House of Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene intends to initiate an impeachment procedure against President Joe Biden for failure to fulfill his duties and failure to ensure protection of America's southern border with Mexico. Marjorie Taylor Greene charged President Biden with systematically trying to destroy America since the beginning of his presidency. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, announced plans to file articles of impeachment against President Joe Biden on Thursday, 18th of May, charging he has violated his oath of office in not securing the country's borders and protecting national security. Marjorie Taylor Greene said at a press conference this will be the first set of articles she introduces against Biden, whom she said has purposefully failed to fulfill his responsibilities of the presidency. Greene said, "It is with the highest amount of solemnity that I announce my intention to introduce articles of impeachment today on the head of this America last executive branch. That has been working since 20th of January 2021 to systematically destroy this country, the President of the United States, Joseph Robinette Biden." Marjorie Taylor Greene made a similar announcement 2 days ago regarding her plans to introduce articles of impeachment against FBI Director Christopher Wray and Matthew Graves, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. Greene said she has also introduced articles of impeachment against Attorney General Merrick Garland and Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas. The Biden White House called Marjorie Taylor Greene's plan a stunt, noting that President Biden is focused on preventing House Republicans' default that would crash the economy. Ian Sams, White House spokesman for Oversight and Investigation, said, "Is there a bigger example of a shameless sideshow political stunt than a trolling impeachment attack by one of the most extreme MAGA members in Congress over national security, while she actively demands to defund the FBI and even said she would have been armed and would have won the January 6th insurrection if only she had been in charge of it." The website Politico has also covered this story and tells us more. Marjorie Taylor Greene initially introduced articles of impeachment against President Biden on the first day of his presidency. She also filed articles against Attorney General Merrick Garland in August, following the search of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago property for classified and sensitive documents taken there. Neither of those advanced in the House of Representatives. The Georgia Republican and ally of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said President Biden has refused to enforce immigration laws and secure the southern border with Mexico, deliberately compromising U.S. national security. She said he has allowed migrants to invade the country while depriving border control agents of the resources and policies that they need to perform their duties. Marjorie Taylor Greene said President Biden has allowed fentanyl to flood into the country and kill Americans every day. She also slammed the administration over its plan to direct Customs and Border Protection, CBP, to release migrants into the U.S. without a set court date or way to track them. Under the plan, migrants need to check in with an app until they're given a court date to appear. Marjorie Taylor Greene said it amounts to catch and release, allowing the migrants to be released instead of being held in custody until their court appearance. She said his policies, directives, and statements surrounding the southern border have violated our laws and destroyed our country. Biden has blatantly violated his constitutional duty, and he's a direct threat to our national security. Article 2 of the Constitution states that the president and other U.S. officials can be removed from office through impeachment and conviction on treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Marjorie Taylor Greene said she wants to take time to gather co-sponsors on her impeachment resolutions. She avoided directly answering a question on what exact charges she would file against President Biden. She said she discussed her plans to file the impeachment articles with other members of the Republican leadership and said they did not ask her not to move forward. She said she is introducing the articles of impeachment because a majority, the base of Republican voters and other Americans outside it, agree with impeaching these officials, describing it as the right thing to do. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, has faced intense criticism from many Republicans over the situation with the southern border with Mexico, which experienced a record number of migrants crossing into the United States in recent months. House Majority Whip Tom Emmer, Republican of Minnesota, called for Alejandro Mayorkas' impeachment recently. The British newspaper Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. According to a recent survey, most US voters say Joe Biden has likely committed high crimes and misdemeanors since becoming president that would justify the Democrat being impeached. The opinion poll comes as Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican congresswoman, introduced articles of impeachment against the president over the migrant crisis at the southern border with Mexico. Some 53% of survey respondents said they thought that President Biden had committed impeachable offences while in office, including 38% who called it very likely. According to Rasmussen report, that's up 4 percentage points since last November. Rasmussen's top pollster, Mark Mitchell, said negative opinions about President Biden's scandals have definitely been gathering steam. The results were partisan. Republicans see presidential wrongdoing as more likely than do Democrats. U.S. House Republicans are investigating President Biden, his son Hunter Biden, and other family members, charging that they engaged in a cash-for-access bribery scheme with foreign nationals. Those allegations relate to Biden's time as vice president in the Barack Obama administration. Survey respondents were asked about wrongdoing since Biden was sworn into office more than 2 years ago. The pollsters did not specify which misconduct Biden was charged with, but the survey comes as Georgia firebrand Marjorie Taylor Greene introduced articles of impeachment against President Biden over a border crisis with Mexico. Taylor Greene charged the president with refusing to enforce the southern frontier and let 6 million undocumented migrants from 160 countries invade our country. Marjorie Taylor Greene added, Biden has failed to properly supply the guards working the frontier and of letting traffickers smuggle fentanyl and other deadly drugs into the United States. Immigration to the United States has for decades been a divisive issue between Republicans and Democrats, but bigger flows of undocumented migrants in recent years and the lapsing of pandemic-era border restrictions this month have raised tensions further. Also, Marjorie Taylor Greene charged FBI Director Christopher Wray and Attorney General Merrick Garland have turned the FBI and Justice Department into Biden's personal police force to prosecute the administration's political opponents. She said that those who participated in the 6th of January 2021 insurrection were mostly peaceful, but Attorney General Merrick Garland has still pursued them. A bipartisan Senate report found last year that 7 people died relating to the attack on the Capitol on that day. She said she is filing impeachment articles against Graves, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, over his prosecutions of 6th of January defendants, which she said have continued while he has declined to prosecute 67% of people arrested by Washington, D.C. police last year.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us. The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers, sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh. And welcome to the program Mafatih al-Hayat, Keys of Life. We are looking at an important key of life, wearing clothes. We have many hadith regarding clothes, and also these hadith are mentioned in the books of akhlaq, morals and ethics, or sometimes we call them makarumul akhlaq, the best of morals and ethics. You can find all these hadith in terms of clothes and how to wear clothes and what to say, what not to say. We will only mention a few, and inshallah we will let you do the rest yourself, I mean the rest of the search. Imam Marza alayhi salam, our 8th imam, when he used to wear clothes, he used to do certain things. Now, I will read it for you, and inshallah, you try to apply it as well. كَانَ يَلْبَسُ ثِيَابِهِ مِمَّا يَلِي يَمِينَهُ. So the narrator says, when Imam Ridha wants to wear his clothes, he starts from the right. فَإِذَا لَبَسَ ثَوْبًا جَدِيدًا. When he wears a new piece of the clothes, دَعَى بِقَدَحٍ مِّن مَّاءٍ. He asks and requests them to bring him a cup of water or a container with water in it. فَقَرَأَ عَلَيْهِ إِنَّا أَنزَلْنَاهُ فِي لَيْلَةِ الْقَدْرِ. He would read chapter al-Qadr 10 times. وَقُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ أَحَدْ 10 times. وَقُلْ يَا أَيُّهَا الْكَافِرُونَ 10 times. So he reads this on the water itself. So he bring the water close to his mouth and he reads 10 times Al-Qadr, 10 times Al-Ikhlas, 10 times Al-Kafirun. And then he would take some of that water that he just read this ayat on and he would sprinkle his clothes, his new clothes, with that kind of water. Then the Imam says, من فعل هذا بثوبه قبل أن يلبسه. Whoever does this to his clothes his new clothes before he wears them. لم يزل في رغد من عيشه ما بقي منه سلك. He says that person who doesn't his clothes before he wears it, he will always be in an ease of life. His life will be easy and will be comfortable. As long as this piece of clothes are still remaining and there are threads of them remaining. Now, this is very simple, very straightforward. You bring a cup of water, you read 10 times Al-Qadr, 10 times chapter Al-Ikhlas, 10 times Qul Ya Al-Kafirun. All together, it's not going to take more than 3.5 minutes to 4 minutes reading these. Okay, go 5 minutes. Maximum 5 minutes. But in these 5 minutes, if you do what Imam Rida alayhi salam has told us to do, then we can bring an easy, comfortable life to ourselves just by doing that action. And also that the Ahl Bayt alayhi salam, like I said, there are plenty of other hadith that they speak about in this regard. So you really need to go and look them up and read and see how you and I, when it comes to our clothes, we can take it more seriously, not just, you know, something that I put on and take off and means nothing and then I throw it whenever I'm done with it. No, no, there's more to clothes and more to the things that we do than meets the eye. Because like I said, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in every act, He has a wisdom. When He told us to wear clothes, obviously there's a reason. So we need to know these things. Let us take a short break, then we will continue.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in the Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life. Now, we said that when it comes to wearing clothes, we have to do the du'as and the Quran required to bless these pieces of fabric that they might make our life a lot better and smoother. In terms of colors, when it comes to the colors of the clothes that we wear or even the shoes that we wear, you'll be surprised to know that there are so many hadiths and narrations from the Holy Prophet and the Holy Household in this regard. They tell us which colors are good, which colors are bad, which colors we should wear, which colors we should avoid. Like, there are so many hadiths in this regard. Now, they call it the psychology of color. You can look it up. There are actually books being written about the psychology of color and how colors affect people. And especially in terms of marketing, they heavily rely on the psychology of color to sell their products. Why, for example, is red? Why is PayPal blue? Why is Facebook blue? These might seem to you as just random colors, but in fact, there's a lot of work done by these companies with these colors. because each one of them has a certain meaning, and when a person looks at it, he perceives certain feelings from these colors. So the Ahl Bayt alayhi wasalam, before this study even people think of it, the Ahl Bayt have spoken about it. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the narrator says, kana yakrahu sawad. The Prophet would hate, he hate black clothes, except in three things. So black, he hates it, except in three situations. One, al-khuf, when it comes to his shoe, he doesn't mind the shoe being black. Wal-imama, his turban is black. Wal-kisa, when it comes to something that he covers himself with, black. So it could be the cloak that he used to wear, or the cape, if we can say cape, and the blanket that he used to wear. If they're in black, he does not mind it. But beside that, he does not wear anything with black. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "Min as-sunnati al-khuful aswad." Amongst the traditions of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is that he wears a black footwear, because we don't know how they used to have the footwear. Is it like shoes, sandals, slippers? Is it like ours, different? We don't know. But at least for our time, as we wear shoes. So he says he used to wear it black. Black is part of the sunnah. وَالنَّعْلُ الصَّفْرَى. When it comes to the slippers, obviously there's a difference between al-khuf and slippers. He says slippers, it's yellowish. And he also said, مَنْ لَبَسَ نِعَالًا صَفْرَى لَمْ يُبْلُهَا حَتَّى يَسْتَفِيدَ مَعْلًا. He says whoever was a yellow sandals or slippers, these sandals, they will not become old and, you know, they start to wear out unless this person will make money. So there is a link between the yellow color when it comes to the shoe and a person making money. You got nothing to lose. Might as well try it. You could possibly make some money by just wearing something yellow, even though you might be saying, well, yeah, yellow in a shoe or a sandal is very hard to digest. I do understand, but you're missing on the money. We'll leave it here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A bill introduced in the U.S. Senate this week would ban American schools from using controversial discipline techniques, including forcibly restraining children and using so-called scream rooms. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A bill introduced in the U.S. Senate this week would ban schools from using controversial discipline techniques, including forcibly restraining children and using scream rooms, which critics say are tantamount to abuse of children. The Keeping All Students Safe Act
introduced by Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, targets all schools receiving federal funding in the United States. Each state would need to submit a written plan for managing situations requiring severe discipline. The move comes after widespread criticism and pressure to end the practices, which Senator Murphy called barbaric. "This is a hidden epidemic in this country," Senator Chris Murphy said. "Kids in schools that are acting out are often being sent into solitary confinement, shoved into what some schools call scream rooms, as punishment, where they're told to sit inside an isolated room, sometimes with padded walls, to correct their misbehaviors. Other children are being restrained, being tied down after they act out. None of this helps these kids." This isn't the first time that Senator Murphy has tried to end restraint and seclusion. He's introduced the Keeping All Students Safe Act multiple times over the last decade, though each previous attempt has failed. Senator Chris Murphy said he's hopeful things will be different this time. "My hope is that Republicans want parents to have a bigger role in schools. We'll take a look at this legislation and see it as something they would support," Senator Murphy said. Senator Chris Murphy may have reason to be hopeful. Some districts have moved to review the use of restraint and seclusion, or even ban it from all except the most extreme circumstances, in response to pressure from parents and activists. Even if it passes, the bill would not address the widespread arrest of elementary-aged children that CBS News reported last autumn. The report highlighted hundreds of arrests of young children in U.S. schools. CBS News analysis of data from the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights revealed that more than 700 children were arrested in U.S. elementary schools during the 2017-2018 school year alone. Children with disabilities and black children were disproportionately affected. Last year, Senator Chris Murphy co-sponsored the Counseling Not Criminalization in Schools Act, designed to address those arrests with more counselors in schools. That bill also failed to pass the Senate. When asked if he plans to reintroduce that legislation, Senator Murphy said, "I haven't made a decision on that yet." New data on schools discipline from the Department of Education, which was delayed due to COVID-19 school closures, is expected to be released this summer. Senator Murphy said he's concerned the numbers won't be good. "I worry that the arrest data is not going to be any better because we have more police inside schools than ever before," Senator Murphy said. "Teachers are stressed out right now. And often what happens is that you've got a police officer in the school and it's tempting to outsource discipline to the police officer. And when you do that, instead of the kid ending up in the principal's office, the kid ends up in the back of a police car." The website jdsupra.com has also covered this story and tells us more. Lawmakers have introduced new bills in both houses of Congress seeking to end schools' use of dangerous disciplinary techniques traditionally employed disproportionately against students with disabilities. The Keeping All Students Safe Act would ban the use of seclusion techniques in schools, referring to the practice of locking students in secluded spaces as a response to certain behaviors. The bill would also reduce the use of physical restraint techniques to counteract real and perceived behavioral outbursts. According to the U.S. Department of Education, some 122,000 students were subjected to restraint and seclusion techniques during the 2015-2016 school year. Of those, students with disabilities accounted for 71% of all restraint cases and 66% of all seclusion cases. Currently, no federal regulations exist concerning such techniques. In May of 2012, the Obama administration released the first federal guidance to schools regarding restraint and seclusion practices. The guidance urged that restraint and seclusion techniques be banned entirely for the purposes of disciplining students and be employed only where there is an imminent danger of serious physical harm to self or to others. Furthermore, the guidance recommended banning the use of mechanical restraints in American schools, the use of any drugs or medications not prescribed by students' medical professional, and the use of any restraint that restricts a child's breathing or harms the child. Schools were also encouraged to improve their parental notification procedures when such practices are used. The Keeping All Kids Safe Act comes as many disability rights advocates in the United States have raised concerns that the current Department of Education may rescind the Obama administration's guidance. It's barbaric for schools to confine students alone in locked rooms or to use abusive methods to restrain little children, said Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, a sponsor of the Senate bill. Treating school kids this way should not be tolerated in America, period, Senator Murphy said. In a letter sent to Congress on 12th of December 2018, the Leadership Conference for Civil and Human Rights, the nation's largest coalition of civil rights groups, listed the bill as one of its top priorities for the new Congress. A version of the Keeping All Kids Safe Act has been introduced each year since 2009. The House of Representatives passed a version in 2010, but that version stalled in the U.S. Senate.
Yani?
Bazaar.
Whether man-made or not, food can have fascinating backstories. Products usually take a long journey before they end up on the dining table. Nevertheless, the food industry follows several golden rules that have helped it steadily grow over time. The most important of these is continuous product innovation and improved production processes to reduce costs and wastage. Others involve packaging and product accessibility, but probably the king of all rules is the taste that drives the food industry.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will be exploring the food industry and its related agricultural markets. We wanted to see how the food sector has expanded over the years and what companies are doing to increase their profits. So let's check out the Tasty Grub.
To become more familiar with how much work goes into food production, we visited Golha Food Industries. It was established nearly a century ago, and its products are now a household name.
It produces hundreds of items in seven categories, such as dried legumes and fruit, spices and canned products. It also takes great pride in its healthy product line, including gluten-free flour products. This producer has devoted a lot of attention to the packaging of its products. Due to its diverse product list, it purchases such materials as cans, plastic, and cardboard to design the appropriate type of storage systems for distribution. The company has a massive daily output due to its expansive production facilities. Most of the work is done by automated machines, but the fine details are handled by experienced staff. All production processes start when raw material enters the company. These materials are first tested for quality before hitting the production floors, most of which are domestically supplied. After being tested, the material is sent to various closed circuit machines for processing. Then it is time for sorting and more quality control tests before packaging.
Food production is a very sensitive process requiring many checks and controls that guarantee the final product is safe for consumption. And production machines play an essential role as they reduce errors and maintain constant output results. Plus, many of these machines have been domestically engineered, whereas they were previously imported at high prices.
This company has a highly equipped quality control and research and development lab. It's where many new products are created and food safety standards are controlled. Moreover, the staff in this department implement food sciences to make innovative products. It might be interesting to know that this department also has some of the best food tasters. This producer has been awarded Best Research and Development Department in Food Production for many consecutive years. Among its many achievements, it has also been awarded the certificate of favored brand by customers. This wouldn't be possible without adhering to strict national and international food safety and production management standards. Following such standards has helped it maintain its export share in the global food market. With years of experience, this company has grown such that it provides thousands of employment opportunities, both directly and indirectly. It also has thousands of agencies and stores all over the country. Plus, its products can also be purchased online. As part of its future vision, this company is looking to increase its market share both domestically and abroad. It also has long-term plans to increase production and improve the production process for efficiency.
The Iranian food industry has taken giant strides away from its traditional production methods. Industry participants say using food sciences and new technologies has helped the food industry grow faster than before. Never more than now has food been more accessible. In fact, it only requires a touch of a few buttons to receive it at home. Therefore, food packaging is a critical part of the production.
Over the last decade, there has been a great emphasis on developing packaging for the food industry. This is because Iran indigenized many machines needed to process and produce food items such as deli meats, beverages, pickles, and so much more. Proper packaging also increases shelf life, which is important for consumers. Previously, food items such as spices and dairy products were purchased bulk from customers abroad due to a lack of packaging. While exporting items in bulk has benefits, it's not as profitable as selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions. Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences.
We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out.
Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules